Good afternoon. This is Erin Fitzpatrick at the Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, August 18th, and thank you for joining us at The Root of It. Thank you to our sponsor, Testa Wines, family-owned business since 1862, and to our producer and engineer this afternoon, Jack Inslee and Nat Weiner. We'll start today's program with the Week in Wine recap. Luxury goods giant Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy has bought a 50% stake in Saint-Emilion's Château Cheval Blanc from controlling shareholder Bernard Arnault. News of this transaction sent the share price of LVMH up more than 10% in early trading on Friday. It also led to resurfacing of the speculation over the future of UK drinks multinational Diageo's 34% stake in LVMH, which the French company denied reports it might sell to back in April. LVMH said the addition of Cheval Blanc would complement the portfolio of super premium wines. Wine Spectator has reported that California is facing its worst oversupply of fine wine grapes in decades. While that's bad news for growers, consumers are in for a potential field day in the next year or two. Growers in Napa and Sonoma have been left hanging without signed contracts, which is due to the recession. Consumers are buying less wine in the $20 plus range. Many wineries, retailers, and wholesalers have a backlog of inventory. The most at risk are new and small growers in coastal areas who don't have long-term contracts. There are signs that the grape glut might be short-term as the economic situation gradually improves. And a new study of the Beaujolais terroir has just been authorized in order to create the first ever classification in Beaujolais. There are two studies planned. The first, which will be carried out by the company Cigales for over €30,000, will examine the climate of the Appalachian's various regions. Impetus for this action is due to the idea that the topography and soils of Beaujolais have not been specifically laid out. In order to clearly identify the specific vineyard plots and to improve the image of Beaujolais, which has more or less been saddled by the Beaujolais Nouveau image of cheap wine, all gives greater incentive to perform these studies. We are going to take a quick break and be back with our guest this afternoon, Brian DeMarco. Welcome back this afternoon to At the Root of It on this steamy August day. Quite hot here in the studio, so we're going to try to keep it light for some comic relief.
Excellent.
That voice you hear, it's Brian DeMarco. He's our guest this afternoon. Brian DeMarco is the owner and managing director of The Barter House, an importer and distributor boutique in New York City. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. As I mentioned, boutique importer distributor called the Barter House, which recently has just kind of advanced its portfolio a little bit further with respect to carrying more wines from new places.
Well, yeah, we've traditionally we're doing the boutique high-end market, and because of the recession, or at least people's reaction to the recession, we've doubled down on our lower under 10, under $12 offerings. And we're keeping our customers satisfied with unique boutique wines that offer value and probably very high taste profiles that you're used to seeing at $20 and $30 wines.
Mm-hmm. So you found that there's been good response to some of the wines that you've added to your portfolio?
Well, at first we did it out of necessity, and now it's become sort of you know, marching orders to find these kind of wines throughout the world. Some person might see us as responding to the glut, like you said earlier, about the California having an excess of grapes.
Mm-hmm.
But we see it as an opportunity where a smart grower will identify various plots of land that make sense for the type of style or style of wine we're looking for. And we jump on it and we do a private label, or we decide to help support their brands.
Mm-hmm. Can you name a few places where you've found these plots that have been viable for these kind of wines?
Well, I think in the U.S. we've seen Santa Barbara really grow. And, you know, it's the sideways effect obviously had some influence on Santa Barbara in general for Pinot. But a lot of people don't realize that they make Cabernet and Syrah, and that these varietals, which, you know, tend to be thought of as higher profile wines, can be blended together. And some interesting, you know, whether it's Cabernet specific or Syrah Cabernet blends, they tend to work out. Likewise, from South America, we found that Argentina has really stepped up its production and private label, and also the Malbec craze is still upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that, you know, those type of wines not only have consumer following, but that wholesalers around the country are looking now for their own version of the $12 Malbec.
Right, right. And you recently also started to work with a winery in Napa who had some Sauvignon Blanc, and we actually interviewed here at the Heritage Radio Network one of your winemakers that you represent.
Amy Aiken.
Amy Aiken. Yeah, hello, Amy. From Meander and from Conspire, which was a new project with Sauvignon Blanc, which you helped commission her to.
Yes, well, yeah. Amy, I know she was on the show, but she is a force of nature, and she is a talent as well as a mother. And
Wonder Woman, I like to call
her.
Yes,
Wonder Woman and rhinestones.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she's a piece of work. But she makes great wine, and I think that she kind of got caught up in the idea of being this super Cabernet aficionado and making these $50, $60, $80 wines. And the reality is that, you know, we need to adjust as well.
Mm-hmm.
And even though her Sauvignon Blanc is a suggested retail of $30 to $40, it's still the quality of the wine. I put that up there with any of the top Sauvignon Blancs in the world.
Yeah.
And it's textured, it's un-oaked, but it has a creaminess and a sort of a way about it that speaks to a $50 wine. And I think that we're buying it and for the mid-20s. So mm-hmm. I think it's still not a value wine, but for the
kind
of... Well,
it's hard, though. I mean, when you look at these new areas, maybe up-and-coming regions within the U.S. And compare them to South America, I mean, the price of the land is so expensive over on the West Coast that it's hard to make those value wines of the same quality where you might find less expensive wine in South America to do the same.
Well, I think there's definitely that. And we've, you know, speaking of, you know, real estate prices and cost of land, cost of labor, it's the same thing with the Hamptons and the Long Island wines.
Mm-hmm.
I was just out in Long Island and I found the same to be true. In rare instances, or I should say in three or four instances that I found, the wines are amazing at very specific places. Overall, the industry either has a lack of awareness for Long Island wines, or because of the land is expensive, the labor is expensive, and people's perception of what they should fetch for those bottles
is
significantly lower.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of out of whack, and whether you want to support New York or Long Island wines is your choice, but if the quality is on parallel, then at least they have a fighting chance.
Sure. Now, you've spending the summer in Long Island doing some research on some Long Island vineyards, amongst other things, i.e. lobster rolling. Some of the wineries that you've seen, what's inspired you?
Well, it's funny because the classic Hampton's rainy day activity is either go to the movie theater, go shopping, or go to a winery.
Yeah.
And depending on your state of mind. For us, it's always go to a winery because it tends to be job specific, but also informative. And one of the biggest problems for us is driving back west because we're in Montauk,
mm-hmm.
and the wineries are on the North Fork or all the way back in Bridgehampton. So once I get that far out east, I'm really kind of reluctant to make the trek. But in this case, we did. In fact, this past week, I was commissioned by a new website called 227.com, which is TO27.com. It's a Hampton's luxury website.
In the Route 27, which we all take out to get to
yes, yeah, the parking lot 27.
Right.
Exactly. And Channing Daughters was the first winery that I wrote about, which is in Bridgehampton.
Love those guys.
They're good folks.
Yeah.
And I had the luxury of sitting, you know, with the winemaker and the GM and the actual husband and wife team. And we drank all the wines and went through all the tank samples. And what I really found was that the white wines are excellent and are on par with stuff that's coming out of Italy or even Austria as far as the grape varietals. And the reds have a little bit of way to go, but there are some very nice, fruity, upfront reds that make sense. And in general, I think the Channing Daughter Winery is probably the finest on the South Fork.
Mm-hmm.
And making wines that are, you know, people find them in here in New York City. And I think their reach is starting to hit Connecticut and maybe even farther south. But, you know, they're a boutique. They make under 10,000 cases a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the wines aren't cheap. But no. I think the quality is pretty high.
Right, right. I was visiting there a few years ago, and I had the opportunity to speak with one of the winemakers there. They were mentioning that the positioning of the vineyard plots is latitudinally on par with that of southern Germany, northern Italy, the Alto Adige area, and thus they've been inspired to plant grape varietals that have originated in Italy and Austria. So they're doing some good work with Tokaj and with Blaufränkisch
And their Pinot Grigio, which I think is probably one of their standout wines. You know, and the article I wrote, which is on our blog, taintedcork.com, has a reference to, you know, put down the Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio and step away from the cooler, because I think when people in this country think of Pinot Grigio, they think of one or two brands, and they think of it maybe even as jug wine.
Right.
Whereas a good Pinot Grigio can offer a lot of pleasure and be a really interesting wine. But I think when it's kind of a watered down sort of, you know, quaffing wine for the summer, it gets kind of this
bad rep.
Yeah, or pizza joint kind of wine.
Right, yeah.
And I think the Channing Daughters makes a pretty solid Pinot Grigio.
In the Friulian
style.
Yeah. You like that. So what's the Tainted Cork, that blog you mentioned?
Oh, it's my sort of alter ego writing about everything from wine, pop culture, liquor, and, you know, my background is in both beer, liquor, wine, and advertising, marketing. So a lot of it is just musings, that things I can't are not allowed to say at work.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put in my blog, and I think that, you know, everyone now seems that, you know, is either Twittering or on a blog or on Facebook, and I know it can get kind of tedious when you see that someone, you know, says, "Oh, I've sat down and opened a fortune cookie," and it's like, "Great, thanks for Twittering that." That really woke up my mind today.
My favorite one is, "It's Wednesday, can't wait for the weekend." Yeah, we all can't wait for the weekend.
Right. And you know, I think that the medium is so fresh and ripe for opportunity and for just, you know, people communicating. And I think the funny thing for me about having the blog
with an ironic name, by the way, because no one wants a tainted cork per se.
Well, I think it's a double entendre,
right,
in many ways. And
yeah.
If you know me, you know that it's an obvious jab at the business and the way that people take themselves way too seriously. And in many regards, it is a very serious business that is wrapped around fun and relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I see it as an experiment in terror, and where by which you go out and you hawk your products and yourself, and you hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
And in the worst case scenario, you find yourself you know, beholden to chain stores or a sommelier who hardly knows anything about wine, that, you know, has very specific goals and very specific ideas about what works for them, and you want to just slap them and say, you don't know what you're talking about, but again, they're the customer. So
sure.
So again, we have the, I have an outlet to kind of rant about these things.
Sure. Well, thank you. We are going to take a quick break and be right back. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today at The Root of It. It's a little Black Uhuru with some reggae this afternoon. My guest today is Brian DeMarco. We just closed off that previous segment talking about his blog called thetaintedquark.com. And for our listeners, Tainted Quark as a blog and as a business might sound as a negative, a double negative, if you will. But there's more meaning to that. Tainted Quark or corked wine. It results when a fungus interacts with a chemical used to sanitize corks and thus produces a compound that taints the wine and yields this musty aroma, funky, mildewy, like to call it wet dog or wet newspaper cardboard aroma. So why did you pick that? Because it conjures up an image that might not be so attractive. Why did you pick that as your blog name?
It's funny you ask because I think at one point I wanted to name this show Tainted Quark, but you wouldn't have it. The key for me was to have something that was light and sort of not taking itself so seriously, something that was about the wine business. And I think I thought of it. I had just been on a trip to Portugal,
okay,
and had been seeing all the cork trees and watched this process. And you know, we import some Portuguese wines as well, which are quite nice. But the whole cork issue came to me when, you know, just being in sort of the wine business and having wines that have either been bad or corked or tainted in some way, it always struck me as, you know, this imperfect science and how, you know, the wine business is an imperfect science.
Sure.
And how that if you listen to, say, Robert Parker or the Berg Hound, and you talk about what happened to 1996 white Burgundies. Well, wow, two bottles of every case.
That's the average these days.
Were
yeah.
corked or, right. or tainted in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it spoke to this big business that was about moving cases and about having this, massive conglomerate involved, and that regardless of it, you couldn't get consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And so my take on it was to kind of poke fun at it and maybe, pop the balloon.
Right. Well, we like it.
Thank you.
And then segueing into your work with the Barter House, I read today in Decanter magazine about private owned label wine sales and how they're so much on the rise, especially during this rougher economic climate. Own label goods on average are about 22% cheaper than equivalent branded products. So places like Sainsbury and Marks and Spencer in the UK have really honed in on creating their own labels and servicing them at their own stores. The Barter House, do you work in some sort of consultancy with respect to private labels?
Why, yes, we do.
Yes, I thought you did.
Yes, well, the private, right now I need my new private label is the new shirt I have to put on after this radio show because it is 110 degrees in here.
It is steamy. It is steamy.
Private label is not a new thing. I mean, grocery stores did private label back as an experiment in the 70s and 80s, and it was this white, thing that said generic on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was typically of similar quality, and it was made by the same people who are making the name brands. It's not so much different now in the wine business. For example, we have a JV joint venture with a winemaker in Argentina who is making, amazing...
In Mendoza?
In Mendoza, Hector de Argudi.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes... Not only does he make wines under his own label, he does private label for probably 20 other people. And you'd say, well, why, why is this attractive? Well, for us, it's attractive because we can offer customers who want something specific, something branded for them, or if we have a product that is exclusive to, say, one chain, you wouldn't want to take the same product to their competitor and have them competing against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be the same product or a similar product, maybe a different blend, but made by the same winemaker. So you can trust the quality, but it has, Sainsbury on it instead of bottle Joe's Bottle Shop.
Sure, sure. So it's the brand recognition. You trust the brand Sainsbury, the bottling that they're going to put out with that wine is good chance it's going to be quite good.
Well, you see the same thing on the high end, you see places like Whole Foods have their own brand when it comes to salsa and chips.
360, I think.
360,
yeah.
And so people trust that because mm-hmm. it's Whole Foods brand. But on the opposite end, you see people like Trader Joe's who do their own wine, and they see the $2 Chuck rose from, which is a private label as well, rose from the ashes of, say, extra fruit, and what are we going to do with this? And
Bulk wine.
And someone sells it for $2 to $5 a bottle, and Trader Joe's does things like that under their label. So it can be everything from a high-end wine that's for a restaurant that wants to have its own wine,
mm-hmm.
or a chain of restaurants, or someone like Trader Joe's who's just blowing boxes.
So how does that process work?
Basically, you source samples of wine, and you look at the wine for the merits of what's in the bottle and not on the package, because I think a lot of us are very, motivated by packaging.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you buy a Louis Vuitton bag over a Gucci bag? Well, because maybe you have an affinity to the brand or the styling of the bag. The same goes with the wine. If you see a wine that has a certain price point and the label is kick ass, you say, okay, this speaks to me. Whereas if you're just tasting the wine, you only can measure it on what's in the bottle.
The quality of it, yeah, right.
And so that I think that really works for us, because the buyers that we're targeting are sophisticated buyers, so they really do want the quality. Because at the end of the day, the buy the glass program at the restaurant, people are less concerned about what's they're really buying and more concerned about what's in the glass.
Mm-hmm. So the first step is that relationship with the vineyard, getting the samples, and then do you take the client through a subsequent process to get to the
shelf? You first identify the need. And identifying the need would be why would someone want a private label and what does it benefit them? One, and they can make more margin. If the brand is their brand, they can reap the rewards for themselves versus paying the markup and the marketing costs associated with having someone else's brand.
Mm-hmm.
And in this kind of economic climate, brands are king. And when people are tight with their money, they gravitate towards brands. And if it's, you know, Sainsbury's private label, people are more apt to probably buy that than take a chance on something they'd never heard of.
Right. Very true. And then where would the customer go for the labeling aspect?
Well, you would do the customer being the buyer.
Would
probably go to a design house or somebody like us at Barter House. We design the labels for our customers, or we have a team of designers that we use. And I think everyone's mother, sister, and aunt, and every person I've ever met who owns a winery has someone they know that thinks they can design a label.
Mm-hmm.
So that is either an amazing thing or a semi-tragic thing.
But you have background in branding and in advertising. So for your buyer, you can help them with the process to identify what consumers are going to look for on the shelf as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the essence of helping someone do their own brand is finding the truth out about what it is that they're about, what it is their company's about. And usually the script is right there.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to really kind of turn the rock over and see what's underneath.
Right.
And all the information you need is there. So when you see things like Mike's Hard Lemonade, which is completely bullshit, fictitious, there's no Mike.
No swearing on at the root of it.
Okay, I'm sorry. isn't this like HBO? Is this cable?
not yet.
I can't do my Larry rant. Sorry. So did I get beeped there?
No, you're fine. Keep moving.
Excellent. Moving right along. I think that I don't even know what I'm saying anymore, but I think it's basically private labels are the future. They're here to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And for customers who it makes sense for, it's definitely a way to keep a lot of the margin in their house.
Definitely. Well, before we wrap up, are there any new projects that you're looking forward to for the fall?
Well, it's funny you say that, because my little sojourn out to the Hamptons for the last 15 days has yielded a possible new joint venture with Raphael Winery on the North Coast. And the North Shore wineries have traditionally been making the best red wines on Long Island. And the winemaker at Raphael is Richard, who has basically defined the AVAs, which AVAs are basically what the regions are. Though there's Hamptons AVA and there's North Shore, you know.
Standing for American Viticultural Area, for our listeners.
Thank you. And I think that their dedication to quality products has been in the market for, you know, 15, 20 years, and they were with a big wholesaler and are not been unhappy with the progress that they've seen mm-hmm. in the growth of their brand. And we kind of stepped in, and we don't know, we don't have a signed deal yet, but
of course,
I think it's something that's on the horizon.
Excellent.
And one thing that I will say about this sort of branding and the idea of Long Island wines is, if you think about New York State and the wines from New York State, no one cared about upstate wines until they had a point of view or a reason for being. And the reason for being is now Riesling. Riesling is now their signature grape.
Sure.
People believe
flagship
of the region. Hudson. So I think Long Island needs to find their way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's Merlot, or maybe it's what the Channing daughters are doing, and they have these various grapes blended together and making these crazy blends. So I think the
that's a good point.
I think the jury's out, and I'm excited to find out where it goes.
Excellent. I am too. Well, thanks so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Miss Erin.
Thank you again to our sponsor, Testa Wines, and our producer and engineer, Jack Inslee and Nat Weiner. I look forward to speaking with you again next Tuesday at 4 p.m. at The Root of It. Signing off.